Alec, good to talk to you and meet you at last. Having read your book, Coevolution, it's good to speak to the man behind it.
Well, it's wonderful to catch up, Barry. You're doing a wonderful job there with the online radio, and it's just a privilege to be able to chat to you.
Now, your book, Coevolution, was actually written about 10 years back, wasn't it? So, and the experiences you had in there, which we're going to talk about, happened quite a few years ago. How do you look back on your book now, 10 years down the track?
Well, I wished I had more courage, Barry, when I first wrote it. There was a lot more to the story than I originally published, and the events that have happened in the last 10 or 20 years since that date have probably, it would suggest to me now, you could be a trailblazer if you like, but it's you need a lot of courage to be a voice in the wilderness, and
yes, indeed.
And Stephen Greer, I think, is almost a voice in the wilderness. Unfortunately, he's the only one telling the truth about a lot of things on this planet. And now I wish that perhaps if I'd written Coevolution in a slightly different manner, it might have helped him even more.
But you got in first, and it's very interesting because I read Stephen Greer's book, almost two books, I think, before I read yours, and I found the correlation between the two. A lot of the information there was amazingly similar, and yet your book had been written a long time before. So when we start to talk about contact with visitors from other worlds, then there seems to be this kind of correlation that exists between your story, Stephen's story, Richard Borland, and so many other people. So it's not just coincidence.
Well, the thing is, Barry, that I did feel I was telling a lone story initially because there were so few stories written about benevolent or friendly interactions. I was surrounded by people with terrifying stories. Once I joined like groups in New Zealand and people that had experience were sharing them with me in private discussion groups. And also some of the books I'd read around about that time to catch up basically with what was going on and being published. And I felt like I was a lone voice. I was telling a story that wasn't dramatic or traumatic. And I sort of felt, why is my interaction different? But of course we've found out since then, thanks to Stephen Greer and some other people, that perhaps those other terrifying stories are not as real in the terms of off-planet interactions as we would perhaps like.
Yes, for those who haven't read Stephen's book, he makes the point that a lot of these so-called abductions are actually manipulated by forces on this planet and not from other worlds for their own purposes.
Yes, well, the first... People have asked me, why didn't you ask this or why didn't you ask that while I was having this interaction? Like, you know, you could come back with a lot more information, perhaps help us out a bit more. And I kind of like it to those almost critical people or debunkers that ask me, why didn't you ask this question or that? I said, well, put yourself in the seat of a Formula One race car for the very first time. You're doing 300 kilometres an hour and there's some corners coming up. What deep philosophical questions do you ask yourself in that situation? It's good grief. Oh my God. Here's a corner coming up at 300 kilometres an hour. What do I do now?
Yes,
if I survive that moment, will I survive the next? And
yes.
You just don't think as deeply as you might when you're resting back in your lounge suite, you know, at home, 3 or 4 months or a year later, and think, oh, all those questions I should have asked.
Yeah. Let's go back to the beginning here now that we're getting your sort of story from this end. Let's start at the other end, back at the time when you were driving out of Auckland and all of a sudden this event happened that changed your life. In effect, you disappeared.
Yes, well, that's the biggest problem I had, Barry, was actually relating where I was at, because I truly did believe that I'd crashed the car and that I was dead and this was some sort of an afterlife. Because
so it had a surreal kind of a feeling
exactly
to it.
Exactly. Nothing had any, well, to me, nothing seemed to have any real definition to it. This seems to be a common theme of the more interesting stories that are coming out now, too, that we're sort of in an etherical world, a world without solid 3D reality that you could grab hold of and carry around. And what I was surrounded with was a load of this, and that even included the interaction with the entities that I met. You can't relate this to an extraterrestrial, or it would be closer to a ghost. So, and because I wasn't too okay with extraterrestrial stories and UFOs and the whole gambit.
So you weren't into it at that stage?
No, I didn't realize that such a thing even existed as interaction between Earth people and interdimensional entities or extraterrestrials or whatever you like to call them. So it was the mind was numbed by the whole event, and it took me most of my interaction to come to terms with it.
So looking back on it now, and this feeling, as you said, you had this. What happened? The car actually stopped, and you feel as if you were sort of then transported into a different reality.
Well, I was driving the car 1 minute, and the next the car was nowhere to be seen, and it didn't feel like I had a body, actually. That's where the death scenario comes into it. I felt totally as if I'd been put through a sieve. I think I mentioned that in the book. It just felt like all the solid parts had been sifted out, and here I was in a sort of a glowing or a ghost-like entity drifting around, not really touching the ground, and having no walls of any description around me in a huge space, and all there was sort of in the far distance were some ghost-like entities, and well, you can imagine.
So did you feel as if, I mean, now it's easy to sort of think about it, but if you can recall at the time, did you feel as if you were sort of an energetic form or just disembodied or what?
Well, that was interesting because I was sort of, while I was drifting around in this almost formless void, I was sort of asking myself questions about, like, how do I move and or should I move? And the thought processes that went through me then led me to being able to move. It was like I could do what I wanted to do by thinking about it, and it's a whole new reality to be in a position where you don't have a body, you don't have legs to motivate or arms to reach. So therefore, the thought of your reality, the thoughts that you need to project to make things happen for you, was what I was getting used to, and it was like going through a teaching process, a self-teaching process. But
did this come to you naturally, or were you given a thought to do this, or what?
Well, this is... I wish I knew. I think that it was self-taught, because I had no idea how long I was in limbo. It could have been a minute, or it could have been an hour, or it was probably actually a day or two. So there was a lot more going on. Time didn't mean anything anymore, and this seems to be another concept we need to get our minds around.
What is time?
Physicality and non-time.
Yes.
So, yes, the difficulty was, if I was teaching myself, what was I teaching myself? Or do we already know this, Barry?
Is it hardwired into us, you mean?
Yes. Is a non-physical body second nature to us?
Well, I think that, you know, the way you describe it, I've had it described by people who've gone into the other world and people I've talked to in the world of spirit. So it's a kind of correlation between leaving the body and going into the world of spirit. You left the body, perhaps, from this description, and went into a different reality, which is tantamount to the same thing, I guess.
Yes, well, I can only assume through technology I was extracted from my physical body.
Yep.
Because the realm that I was then in was now, in relating to where we are now, non-physical. And this is the biggest step that you need to take in your mind, is that a lot of extraterrestrial interactions into the non-physical realms, and this would account, of course, for why a lot of spacecraft are not seen in our
atmosphere. Not seen, yeah, that's true.
There's probably, as I look out the window, there's probably half a dozen in the sky somewhere now that I would never see. And this seems to be the case. And we've got, and of course, our governments and military have got so much more sophisticated technology now, and they can actually pick these things up, which
yeah, of course.
Do 50 years ago. So.
Now, just before we get into your adventures, which were absolutely wonderful and chronicled so well in your book, Co-Evolution, just before we get into that, when you then came back at the end of all this, did you feel as if you were zipping back into a physical form, or was there a big change in this? How did that all happen?
Pretty seamless technology, I have to say, Barry. I did bring back some memories of A, perhaps being given a body that would work in the situation I was in while I was interacting off-planet, and I did have a vague memory of being given a body back again for the Earth end of the story, basically going back into my own physical body. I do have vague snatches of memory of that, but I was told at the time that the technology that was being used isn't sort of conducive with the memory of it. It's way beyond my capabilities of even explaining.
Yeah.
So yes, at the end of it, I seamlessly seem to move back into my own physical body. I can only assume then that perhaps my own physical body either didn't go on this trip, or if it did, it was in storage.
Yes, I was going to ask you, did you have any thoughts or concepts or any answers as to what happened to your body during this time? Because it was about 10 days, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I can only, as you alluded at the beginning to the car going with me, I'm sure the car wasn't just left on the side of the road.
I'm sure it wasn't, otherwise it would have attracted
10 days, the police would have probably come and towed it away as a derelict or something, I don't know. Because I assumed at this stage that I'd crashed, but I don't think that happened either. I guess I just don't know how my body and car travelled, whether that was in storage.
Whether that was there or not. But at the end of it all, you came back again, and the way you sort of were able to see that you were still wearing the same clothes, weren't you, and nothing had been changed, that was quite a strange little episode of what you came back to.
Exactly as I had left it, exactly as I had repented leaving Rotorua for that 3-hour drive. It's only a couple of hundred kilometres from Rotorua to Auckland, which I was doing at the time, and when I arrived in Auckland, I didn't really have a memory of anything untoward happening at all, except that I did feel strangely orientated. But there were, as the book explains, some other extenuating circumstances there.
Sure.
But notwithstanding that, I did feel pretty weird, I can tell you, and also afterwards, I couldn't relate left to right. Just the physical. Just physically being back in a body, I couldn't orientate myself properly. I felt like I was getting lost in Auckland City, and I'd been in the city for 40 years, growing up there, and yet I kept getting lost when I was driving around the street. So I was definitely disorientated. So there was some getting used to that again.
Yeah. Sure. Since then, how do you react if people say to you, oh, look, you probably made all this up, you went and parked the car for 10 days somewhere and came back with a nice story to write a book? Have you had that?
Yes, I wish it was that simple. writing books was the last thing on my mind, and it actually took, how many years? Probably 8 years before I actually wrote the story up in a form that could be published. So it wasn't the first thing on my mind. Oh, I need an experience so I can write a book. Normally wait 8 years to do that. And even then, I thought, no one's going to believe me. And I didn't really even want to write it at all.
Yeah.
But whatever caused the experience in the first place also almost forced me to write the book. I wrote out a draft and put it away, and something just kept me going back to it and wouldn't let me leave it alone. But of course, yes, well, st- start off with, we were travelling, what I was told, that we were travelling not only in time, but into another dimension. But the real catch to the story, which made the whole thing sort of really hard to get your head around, is that this was an artificial dimension that this race had constructed for themselves. And to relate to that, you have to really hear their entire story, which we can't do here. But they were aware of an evolutionary process, which seems to be prevalent right throughout our cosmos, our universe, and that is that when a species evolves, it doesn't do it gradually in the Darwinian theory, but it just takes one step forward of a monumental leap where it actually transposes the physical species into another new reality.
We're talking about that at the moment, aren't we? Calling it ascension.
Yes, it almost seems almost too simple. It seems to be that what this race was trying to do was artificially, if you like, accelerate that process.
Right.
And they obviously had the technology to do so. And I think that there's a few covert groups on this planet that are a bit more au fait with that sort of technology than we ever led to believe. But anyway, this group of people that I interacted with obviously had the technology, and they actually accelerated their whole race, planet, and their whole solar system, it would seem, into another reality, a less dense reality.
That's amazing, isn't it?
The process, the reasons were so that they could have interstellar travel.
Yeah.
It seems to be that you need to be able to transport yourself into a less dense reality to be able to travel.
So raise the vibrations is another way of maybe looking at it.
The technology is absolutely amazing, and so obviously beyond my comprehension. They always seem to pick on the wrong people to take.
Well, I mean, we talk about the density of life on Earth, so that when we go back into spirit, the spirit world is vibrating at a much higher level than we are. So perhaps they were looking at trying to be able to access that domain.
Well, it seems to be, Barry. They engineered an artificial heaven.
that's exactly what I'm thinking.
So that they could interact with our universe in a less dense reality, and so they could then travel faster than light and a lot of other things, and so explore for themselves everything they desired to do.
Yes.
But I did touch a more sort of a real technology on their planet, because that's where I was taken. But of course, I can't relate the density of that planet to Earth. But all I could tell you is that it felt real to me, as solid as anything that we would have on planet Earth.
Were there other similarities in this world? I mean, did it look as if there was ground and rocks and mountains and?
Yes, everything that you would expect to find here, but the technology was absolutely stunningly beautiful, Barry. Yeah. That was the thing that lingered with me the most, I think.
The technology was stunningly beautiful.
Well, the way
how do you explain that?
I call it technology, but it wasn't so much nuts and bolts as it was an interaction of a biological technology. Where they sort of seem to be able to splice animal and vegetable materials together to get living entities which serve their needs. And I mean, an example of that would be to grow your own house.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah.
And the house then had a built-in ability to read your mind, and you could command the house to do basically whatever you needed it to do. A bigger window, a smaller window, warmer temperature, whatever the case may be. Insulation from the heat in the day and insulation from the cold at night.
I'm negotiating with a builder at the moment. It doesn't work out. I wish it were just as easy. The house, would you mind just doing that? How wonderful.
And, of course, the cost seems to be negligible. I mean, they didn't use money as we would understand it. And I guess you wouldn't really
need it.
It's like growing beans in your backyard.
Exactly. Exactly. Why would you need money? I mean, what a wonderful... I mean, and the name of the place is called Haven, which is so close to heaven anyway, wasn't it? It was heaven with the E left out.
Well, that's just... that's another thing I really need to talk to you about, Barry, is the way they communicated. It was a vibrational frequency, if you like, but it was in the vibrations of colour. I think our science is just starting to realise that, there's been colour therapy around in alternate medicine for a long time now, and I think it's just starting to get the credibility in the mainstream that it deserves. Obviously, our bodies relate to vibrational frequencies and resonances beautifully, and it seems that that's the way they communicate it in a colourful vibrational resonance, and I can't explain it any better than that.
But if you look at the word universe and break it down, uni meaning one and verse meaning song, everything is one song.
Exactly so. They obviously, they were a long, long way ahead of us in their understanding of nature and the universe.
And as you said before, you write it at length in the book about the interaction between the human, the animal world, the vegetable world, and even the rocks, the makeup of the planet itself, that we are all one and we can interact with each other.
Well, I think that every atom in the universe is intelligent, or so I was told, and it seems to be that way. Trees are a lot more than just a lump of wood growing out of the ground. I think there's some sort of antenna that feeds the earth a lot of the cosmic energy. I think the human body, being a walking aerial, is doing exactly the same thing. And our DNA strand seems to be nothing more than a living aerial for cosmic energy and instructions on life.
And I think we're starting to realise that. I was reading in the weekend about the Australian and US governments now getting together to plant trees instead of ripping them down.
Is that right?
Isn't that wonderful? They're waking up.
Yes, I think that trees are part of the life energy of the planet, and every time you cut down a tree, you are physically killing the planet, not just altering the atmospheric behavioural patterns like rain. I mean, they call them rainforests for a reason, don't they, Barry?
That's a very good point, Alec. Yeah, very good. Anyway, back to Haven. And here you are in this amazing place with this. Everybody or everything seems to be sort of integrated. The journey that you're getting there in this craft and everything, well, that's a different story as well. I mean, there's just so much to talk about here. Where do we pick it up from?
Well, the spacecraft itself, Barry, was just another derivative of this animal-plant mix. I think that we're starting to realise, those that have studied the ET phenomenon in any detail, that everything's biological. There's not so much nuts and bolts, there's not so much metal in any of these craft as maybe there is in some of the very primitive ones that they might be able to shoot down. But I think that the more high-tech races use a biological machinery, and it integrates with them. They are part of the machinery, and I don't think the craft actually would operate without them.
Yes, well, Stephen Greer talks about this too, about operating through the thought and through the consciousness of the inhabitants of the vehicle.
That's right. Well, the technology that I had anything I touched, they seem to meld with it more so than I did. I was like an apprentice, I guess, so I probably wasn't qualified, or even I wouldn't have been allowed to. But whenever they interacted with their craft, it's almost like they molded into it. In the true sense, that when they touched the control panels, I swear their hands became part of the control panels, which you could only do with a biological machinery.
Exactly. I mean, we're so used to thinking from the word go, you know, from chariots, horse-driven chariots of thousands of years ago through to our modern transportation, that we get into something or climb onto something and it is totally separated from us. That's our concept of transport. And I think that's our limitation of transport too, isn't it?
Well, they didn't eat anything, Barry. They only drank a sort of a cosmic solution. I'm sure that whatever they took into their bodies would make them meld with their technology, because it seemed to be part of the same structure. Yeah. I mean, the closest I can get to that in Earth terms is there's a substance called white powder of gold, which was written up in Nexus many, many years ago, which seems to be interdimensional. and has properties of anti-gravity. It just it is the magic elixir, if you like.
That's right. It is supposed to be the original elixir of the alchemists as well.
Exactly. I think the ancient Egyptians knew about it probably through their extraterrestrial heritage. But
yes.
It seems to be that, this is a crystalline form of gold, or the higher state, what they call high spin metals like rhodium and etc.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to be that everything is constructed from a crystalline substance, which is, I think, the bedrock of the alien technology. And it seems that technology is compatible with both animal, vegetable, and mineral. And that's the magic link. I'm sure there'll be some laboratories on Earth that are experimenting with that sort of technology.
Oh, look, I'm sure Lawrence Gardner, in his books, has written about this as well on several occasions. So I think it's been pretty well known for quite a few centuries.
Well, if the ancient Egyptians were using it for enlightenment of their so-called light or soul bodies,
yes.
Around for on this planet, and people have known about it for 10,000 years plus.
Yeah, indeed.
The question is, Barry, why don't you and I know a lot about it?
Well, because there's probably people who don't want us to know anything about it.
Could be right. Just like there's a lot of people that don't want to know about interdimensional interactions, or don't want us to know about it, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true. I'm talking to Alec Newald about his book Coevolution, and we'll take a break and then come back again and explore a little bit more about life on the planet of Haven. You're listening to Radio Out There. Okay, Alec, you've travelled in this amazing craft, and for more details, it's best if people get hold of the book and read about that, because there's some interesting things that happened on the way in, including you meeting various entities, people from this other world, and then by the time you got to the planet itself, you were actually taken in charge by a very interesting personality.
Yes, I'm writing a second version of Coevolution to explain that in more detail, but just to stick with the path that I used on the original story. Yes. And here again, I use the name of Xena for this female entity which seemed to become my guide, because there would be no way to use a name sound that would be compatible with my tongue.
Mm.
Her name was basically a vibrational frequency, so I just tuned it down to a sound that was as close as I could make with my own tongue.
Right.
So the name doesn't really mean a lot. But anyway, this entity, as a guide and mentor, ran me through not only their own history, but some of our own as well, of planet Earth, which was very interesting. I'll perhaps leave that to people that want to read the book. Some of it's probably well enough known, but some of it might not be. But their own planet, as I said, was catapulted into a dimension that didn't really fit with the rest of the cosmos. And so they're out on a limb in a dimension that I labeled as 3.5, just for want of a better name. So they're finding it difficult. They've actually built themselves a coffin, I think. This reality is not stable, and it won't last forever. They've got to get out of that situation at some stage, and they're fighting as hard and as fast as they can with their technology to get themselves into some sort of a situation where they could actually travel back half a dimension, which would bring them into our reality.
Ah, so they want to regress at this stage now.
Yeah, yes. They have to. They can't go any further forward for technical reasons that I don't understand. And having travelled that far forward, they back themselves that they can re-engineer their direction backwards. They have to get back into a reality which would fit with ours. And so the reason that they are visiting Earth, or planets like Earth, is to try and grab samples of not only plant life and animal life, but also intelligent life, to see if it's possible for them to splice themselves back down the ladder of evolution. Very interesting situation.
Interesting. How interesting. So, can you sort of give us a description of Xena and the other people on the planet of Haven? I mean, we've had and seen so many different kind of representations, shall we say. The little greys seem to be almost like the generic off-world visitor. Were they anything like the greys?
Well, I can actually elaborate a little bit on that, Barry. Interesting, Stephen Greer's book has some relevant detail on the so-called Zeta Reticuli, or the greys.
Yes.
That was the only image I had in my head when this interaction of mine happened. It's the only, any reading I'd ever done before about extraterrestrials, the only image I'd ever seen was of your, you know, standard grey entity with the black eyes and big black eyes and small spindly bodies. And I actually asked them, what's the story with these other entities that I'd read about or seen some in some magazines? And they gave me an answer which actually surprised me. They said, well, those entities come from a lot closer to home than you could imagine. And without going into much more detail, and that sort of threw me, much closer to home. Do you mean you're a native of Earth? They didn't say that in so many words, but that was what they were hinting.
Mm.
And, of course, Stephen Greer has come up to say that some of these grey entities are quite possibly biologically manufactured by some covert agencies and on planet Earth for their own purposes.
For their own purposes.
Yes, so that threw me a loop, to say the least.
By the way, when we've been talking about Stephen Greer, his book is Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, those people who may be tuning in and wondering about that. That's the book we're referring to.
I would reckon that is the book of the century as far as I'm concerned.
But anyway, true enough.
Back to these entities that I was interacting with. Now, they'd already attempted, by the sound of it, to back-engineer their race to a level that was more compatible with ours, and that was another of the experiments they were trying to test by coming to Earth and asking if we would like to interact with them.
Mm.
The premise that I was abducted off planet Earth isn't quite accurate, actually. It's very hard to explain when you're suffering from amnesia that you'd given people permission to come and visit you and then you'd forgotten that the invitation had been given. But that was the situation with me. Mm. I'd forgotten that this was okay.
Yeah.
So there wasn't any negative connotations to this interaction at all. I was given free rein, free choice, and free will at every turn. But anyway, so this Xena personality, this Xena, who was my guide and mentor for the trip, was a back-engineered hybrid, I would guess, would be the best way to describe her.
Yeah.
Still a long way ahead of the human race in spirituality and technology and knowledge, but very human-like. Not sure that she could walk down the street and not be noticed as being something slightly different than human, but only a few sections removed from that. But there was an elder race, which were, I would say, the founding race of these peoples. They called themselves elders because they seemed to live for... I call them elders anyway. They seemed to live for a very long time.
Mm.
They were probably closer to a grey Zeta Reticulan than anything else I could describe, except that their eyes were very dark blue, not black, and they did have pupils, be it more like a cat's pupil than a human's.
Mm. Mm.
So, but of course, they were in such a dire strait that they couldn't actually survive in their reality without a biosuit, which was a fully protective, glove-like suit that they had constructed for themselves, both on their planet and for space travel. They had to wear variations of this bio suit.
Well, that makes sense when you see, I mean, not every person in the species can look exactly the same, which is what we tend to sort of depict the Zeta Reticuli like. So it would make sense to think that it is like some kind of skin-fitting suit that would hide the individual features.
Yes, these are the elder race were very small. They were between 3 and 4 feet tall, so they were tiny compared with the hybrids, which were between, say, 4 and 5 feet tall. So obviously the genetic manipulation was making a stronger, bigger race. The problem I think they had is that the planet Haven is quite small, possibly not a lot bigger than our moon, or almost exactly the same size as our moon. So they had spent many thousands or millions of years developing on a planet that had perhaps 1/6 or 1/4 of Earth's gravity. To transport yourself to a planet like Earth, you would feel like a lead brick, I'm sure.
Imagine, yeah.
So a strength factor was one of the problems they had to recreate.
But was there the same atmosphere on Haven as we have on Earth? Were you able to breathe freely?
Well, I could, but of course I had possibly had my body assimilated to match theirs more than not, so I couldn't be exactly sure.
So you've gone through some kind of process on the...
We've got an alternating reality here of me being transported or transposed into their reality while they're trying to transpose themselves into our reality, and the technology there would be mind-boggling, and I couldn't even go there and try and explain it, Barry.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough, too. That's fair enough. So when you got there, Zena and her family were looking after you, and you were almost sort of like matched up with Zena. Did you get that feeling? Because that's what came over in the book.
I think it was certainly they wanted me to be comfortable with her. The family, I don't know, because I don't know how these hybrids are formed. I guess they're manufactured in some way. I have no idea. Cloning wouldn't be right because they don't look anything like the elders. So exactly the technology there, I wouldn't know. But it seemed to be that they wanted me to befriend Zena, or she wanted me to befriend her. I guess that was the plan, and it worked out quite well. We seemed to be, if you like, connected at a soul level, and that's a whole new story too, because that's basically what we're delving into here. Because they're not as physically dense as we are on planet Earth. You are getting into the sphere of the afterlife or soul reality or non-physical beings. So
are you developing that line of thought with your second book?
Yes, this is where Stephen Greer jolted me into a space that I should have been in when I probably wrote the first version of Coevolution.
Things in time, Alec.
Yes, I wasn't brave enough to talk about out of body experiences to the point where I'm talking about light bodies or soul bodies, which we all seem to possess, which is also another factor that seems to have been denied our mainstream reality. I firmly, Barry, believe in an afterlife and a rebirth, and I think the human soul is immortal, and it would seem to be the same for these extraterrestrials. And as we were actually interacting on more of a soul level rather than the physical level, it seemed to be that was just as important to them. I guess they were scared that if they manufactured an artificial body, which would seem that that's almost what they were trying to do, they would lose their souls. And it's a scary thought, but perhaps they thought that they could not continue to replicate themselves or reproduce themselves and have a soul take residence in that body if it was too much of an artificial construct. So that's the storyline for Coevolution 2.
Yeah, okay, we'll look forward to that. Okay, let's take another break and then come back and coming under the eye of the authorities. Now, tell us a bit about that.
Yes, well, I think that there are a few covert groups around the planet that obviously know a lot more about extraterrestrial interaction or extraterrestrial technology than the average guy in the street, and that would include me. I think that they've known a lot more about this stuff for a very, very long time, probably going right back to the 1940s. I can't talk about it because I'm not on the inside. I'm not in the know. But, of course, as you know, that's what Stephen Greer is trying to bring out into our reality, is people that have been on the know on the inside with his disclosure project.
That's right. And, of course, it's the 60th anniversary of Roswell this year.
Yes.
And Roswell happened, amazingly enough, on my birthday, would you believe, the 7th of July. So I'm feeling more and more drawn to this whole area.
I think you're part of the day, whether you like it or not.
Whether I like it or not.
I think the whole entire human race is part of it. Unfortunately, it's left to a few people like Stephen Greer to drag us all up to speed at great cost, usually to yourself and your family and the finances and everything, because what happened to me on, we're just having a heavy shower of rain. It's unusual.
I was wondering what the sound was there.
It's making it hard to hear, that's all.
That's okay, no, we'll got you.
Anyway, where was I?
Oh, talking about what happened when you came back again.
Yes. It seems to be that there are a group of people on this planet that want to make life difficult for anybody that cares to tell the truth to their neighbours, if you like, to fellow humans. And I met up with a group of very nasty people that seem to know more about my adventure than I did. And their first manoeuvre was to try and extract information from me any way they could, even basically lying about their identity and who they represented. I soon found out that they couldn't be who they said they were. And then, when I wasn't forthcoming with any information, they proceeded then to try and make sure that I didn't talk to anyone else about it. And they threatened me in no uncertain manner, both physically and mentally.
And this is in nice, quiet New Zealand.
This is in, yes. I was felt I was living in a third world country, to tell you the truth, Barry.
And they were New Zealanders. They weren't men in black with American accents or anything.
Well, one of them had a British accent for sure, and it would appear that he was working for a UK-based covert agency, which very few people know about, and it's not MI6, it's beyond that, I think. And he was in perhaps escorted or in collusion with some form of operation in New Zealand, which were probably just backing them up with manpower, I guess. They wouldn't know too much about what was going on. But anyway, these people were not nice. That would be the politest thing I could say.
Yeah. Did they ever threaten you outright?
Well, they actually threatened my family and me physically. They actually beat me up at one stage. And then when that didn't work, they blackmailed me, basically, or tried to. Used extortion, and they ended up by framing me in some sort of what you could call a criminal sort of charge. They conceived to draw out of a hat like a magician and the rabbit.
Yeah, the trumped up charges, as we.
But that wasn't enough for them. I mean, the threat of saying, well, if you don't cooperate, we're going to send you to jail, I was quite prepared to wear that.
But you weren't writing, you weren't speaking out of the
I hadn't at that stage.
No. So why were they being so heavy, Owen?
Well, of course, every time they made life more and more difficult for me, the more resigned I was to the fact that I was going to have to talk about this publicly. And I think they were scared that I had information, a little bit like Stephen Greer, that could be a bit of embarrassment to them. For instance, you're not supposed to be allowed to have friendly interactions with extraterrestrials. That was definitely a no-no.
Oh, none of us realised that. I didn't realise that you weren't supposed to. So if you see an extraterrestrial, you say, go away, the government doesn't like me talking to you.
You're only supposed to have scary interactions.
Oh, right.
It was really frightening, and So there's a story building there, which Stephen Greer touches on in this Disclosure Project too, which is that maybe in a very short space of time, in the next few years, we may well have some alien visitors, which are nasty little fellows, and they're going to blow the human race up.
Oh yeah, well that's the whole movement. I just heard this morning that there can be some disclosure by the French government on the way.
They have actually opened up some of their books, but it's very superficial stuff at this stage.
But anyway, it's a start. Mm. It's a start.
There still is a very strong group of people on this planet that want to keep a lid on all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And they can't have rogue people like me roaming around talking about it.
Of course not.
Even if I don't know anything, because they didn't know how much I knew. So they were being safe, if you like. Put the lid on whether he knows anything or not, shut him up. So.
Did you get whipped off and told, you know, how much did they try to question you or anything like that?
Oh, well, I mean, I had interrogations in jail afterwards. The thing was, before they actually stuck me in jail, is that they took 2 years to do it, Barry. It was extortion. It was like, this is going to happen to you. And I can tell you, living under that threat is the worst thing that I have ever suffered in my life. Knowing that the guillotine's going to fall, but not knowing when, it takes away all the pleasure of life.
Mm.
It wasn't one day that I could have a nice, if you like, if something nice was happening to me, in the back of my mind always was, oh, hell, you know,
yeah.
I've got this to contend with yet.
But that's the sort of Damocles principle, isn't it? You know, make you frightened and keep you under control through fear.
And, of course, all the time they were saying, this will go away if you just do this or just do that or just shut up or don't say anything or just sign here. Or come and have a military debriefing and we'll own your story and you won't be able to talk to anyone about it. That was the...
Which explains, of course, why so many other people don't speak out.
Well, yes, and I feel a little guilty when I wrote Co-Evolution. I left the real nasty stuff out. I mean, there's bad enough stuff in there as it is, but I left the beatings and the threats to family out of that.
Yes, this is the first time
I really felt... Hell, no one is going to talk about this if they know what I'm going through. Yeah. I mean, it would just scare everyone off.
Yes.
And I thought, well, it's up to people to make their own mind up at the time, at the moment, if they want to contend with this or they want to fight it or if they want to talk about it. I didn't want to put them off before they even got near the subject, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I feel a little guilty about not disclosing the hardships after the fact, but...
Well, it was a conscious decision.
Yes. I mean...
So what about when the book came out? Did that produce any kind of reaction?
No. Funnily enough, you might ask Duncan Rhodes of Nexus Magazine about this, because when he published a few chapters prior to the publishing of the book itself...
Mm.
He told me that was his consignment to the printer for that month's edition of Nexus was intercepted in the courier bag. All the editorial material was stolen out of it. That's the first time that's ever happened to him.
Really?
Was that all the editorial material out of Nexus magazine was lifted out of a courier bag. And he doesn't even know now how that could have happened.
No. Well, that was before my association with Duncan, so I hadn't heard that story.
Yes, that's very interesting. Told that to me. It's not been published as such, but so someone was certainly very interested in what I was going to get published in Nexus or the book, because this was an excerpt out of the book.
Indeed.
But then, just before that again, Duncan invited me to talk at one of his Nexus conferences in 1996, I think it was. And by that stage, I had a criminal conviction, thanks to our little covert friends. And so I would have needed a visa to visit Australia. Normally, as you might know, New Zealanders don't need visas to visit Australia.
No.
But if you have a criminal conviction, of course, you would have to get one.
Of course.
So I applied for one, and they wouldn't give me one. They said, no, you can't. You cannot travel to Australia.
You're dangerous. You talk to extraterrestrials.
Anyway,
I'm probably going to be in trouble just for talking to you.
I think they're all under the bridge since then, and Stephen Greer, I think I feel a bit safer now that he's on board.
Good for you.
No, they wouldn't even let me travel to Australia. Duncan had to write a five-page five pages begging letter to the Australian consulate. They said, please, Leila, come and visit and speak at our conference. And they ended up giving me a 10-day business visa or something. I made sure I wasn't going to be in Australia for very long.
Exactly. Oh, yes.
You could have been the downfall of the country, Alec. if you need proof that government agencies are in cohorts here and are keeping people quiet, then that's one provable section of this adventure.
All right, so now 10 years on, the book's been out, you're into Coevolution 2. How has it changed your life when you look back? Can you put that in a sort of a nutshell?
Oh, totally. yes, I'm not so focused on the material world anymore, I guess, Barry. I'm excited to find out that I have an eternal soul and that I'll never die, and that what I'm learning here is not about how much money I can make and how many chattels I can accrue. What I'm learning here is how to live a decent life, and it just puts different values into your thoughts, and you want to do different things, I can't quite explain it, but it's just a whole new philosophy of life, and I wish that if everybody could have had this experience, every person on Earth would have a different philosophy of life.
That's
and
true.
What a wonderful planet we would have if we weren't trying to beat each other over the head to grab the shiniest ball or something.
Exactly. What about contact after that? I mean, you disappeared for 10 days, and then you had this amazing trip to another world, had this contact, and you seem to be left alone after that. Have you had any further contact?
No, I think that whatever the deal I'd made with this group of people, that honored that deal, that they, whatever they needed from me they got, or whatever I needed from them I got, and that was the enlightenment. And I think, I guess that's the end of that chapter.
That's it. So you don't feel used and abused or anything like that?
Beg your pardon?
You don't feel used and abused?
Oh, no. Only by the downside of it on this planet when I got back. I've definitely been used and abused, but not by anything off planet.
Yeah.
No, I feel that they've given me a gift, this gift to understand who I am and a little bit more about the physicality of the human body that I could never have learnt on planet Earth. And or less perhaps I had gone up to Tibet and sat with a monk for about 20 years or something. I might have learned a little bit about it, but this was a
but this was the best way. Yeah, fair enough. All right, so Coevolution 2 is in the melting pot at the moment. When can we look forward to seeing that?
Well, it's going to be a while, Barry. I have a drawing to go to Mexico and South and Central America in the next few months, in the next half of this year.
Right.
I think there's something I need to see there. I don't quite know what it is yet. So I'll finish writing Coevolution 2 when I get back from there. So probably be looking at another 12 months down the line.
Fair enough. Well, if something happens in South America there, we expect you to come on the program and tell us. Something wonderful.
I have pleasure in doing so, though, as long as I'm still here in the physical.
No, that's right. That's true. Now, and Coevolution 1, is that readily available still?
You can get it from Duncan Rhodes at Nexus Magazine. I'm sure he still has a few copies lying around there. That would be the best way.
Right.
I think they're occasionally available secondhand on Amazon, the online bookstore. But definitely get them from Duncan Rhodes.
From Duncan Rhodes at Nexus. All right, great. Alec, it's been wonderful talking to you and sharing your amazing journey. Really, you know, the book goes into far, far more detail, and I can only recommend that to those people who want to find out more about it. But great to talk to you. And as I said, we expect to hear from you after South America if something really wonderful happens.
It's been a very great pleasure, Barry. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Alec Newell, and his book Coevolution is available through Nexus Magazine.